Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Cash Only is a British DJ, producer, record label owner, promoter, booker, tour manager, and possibly most innovatively creative youth project director and facilitator with a career spanning over 30 years. Cash Only took a hiatus from the music world and built the largest independent group of children's residential social care homes for children aged 6 to 16 in the West Midlands, employing over 180 staff across 15 sites over a 10-year plan. Cash Only released his first EP in 2012, and after selling the children's residential social care homes, released music again in 2023. His release schedule quickly grew, seeing records signed to the iconic Nervous Records alongside King Street Sound, Electronic Nature, Divine Sound, Upcycle, and New State. In early 2024, his track Salsa House by himself and DJ Fenn sat at number one in the garage chart for over 2 weeks, with other releases regularly sitting in the genre charts for a number of weeks. During this time, he has worked with a number of high-profile vocalists, including Alex Mills, Rains, and Holly Ellison. Cash is the label manager for Divine Sounds and also set up his own label, Famous When Dead Records, in 2025 as a platform to predominantly self-release, but to also feature artists he holds in high regards. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Cash Only. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. And I am in Cheshire, which is a kind of poshest suburb of Manchester. So yeah, we live on a golf course. There's lots of greenery, but equally, you know, it's close to like major cities like Manchester, and it's only a couple of hours from London on the train. So, you know, and we're right by the airport, so it's quite connective. But yeah, we're in the countryside basically.
How and where and what was the choice behind the stage name Cash Only?
So yeah, everyone asked me that. And no one would ever guess the real reason. But the real reason is it's a piece of art that I bought in 2012. So I've been DJing, making music, producing, promoting, doing all sorts of stuff in the music industry for about 30 years. And in 2012, I was DJing under a different name. And it was more kind of UK garage and kind of shows like that. And I wanted to go in a little bit more of a housey direction with some of the music that was influencing me in 2012. So there's a really cool street artist that I like, and his name is Famous When Dead, which I think is a great name as well.
Yes.
I've actually got a record label with him now called Famous When Dead Records. But anyway, I love this guy's art, and I was drawn to this piece, and it's like it was a piece of painted art, and it's just got a big Cash Only stamp over this guy's face. So I bought that, and I thought one day when I was thinking of a new name that I needed for this kind of journey into the house world, maybe that could work as a name. And I think over the years, and especially now and post COVID, it's such a relevant name, and it's a great piece of marketing because people around the world, they take pictures of stuff, markets, or, you know, they're in Thailand somewhere and they've just got this really poorly written in English sign that says Cash Only, and like people tag me and stuff all the time. So I think it's quite a cool name. However, a promoter once, they had on the flyer, it said Acid Harry Cash Only, and someone commented, I'm not sure if this is an advertisement for drugs or some DJs. So yeah.
And when did you meet the artist? How long after getting that painting did you meet him?
Yeah, so I knew him. He was a local guy in the Midlands where I was living at the time, and yeah, I really liked his work. And yeah, so now he does all of the artwork for the record label that we had together. And he does lots of other bits and pieces for me. You know, his work is quite dystopian, abstract. And yeah, I just think that there's a lot that can be done with sound and vision, especially in 2025, where a lot of people go into events, you know, to film it. You know, people are digesting music more with their eyes than they are with their ears a lot of the time. So it's a concept that I had to bring kind of the worlds of sound and art together a little bit more. And in September, we're going to drop our first event, and I want it to be like a fusion of art meets kind of music. And I just want to promote everything that we do through whatever art form is relevant. So it could be a, you know, really cool design t-shirt. It could even be a piece of art that you buy. I'm playing Glastonbury and, you know, we're thinking of doing like a limited edition print that we can sell, maybe raise a bit of money for charity. And obviously you can buy my music as well. So yeah, that's the whole concept, and that's where the name comes from.
Okay, so now let's rewind to the very beginning. So at what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you feel cool? I want to be in this space. And how did that journey progress?
Funnily enough, my daughter reminded me. She said to me, did you used to be in a band? And I was like, I totally forgot about that. So when I was about 13 or 14, I was really into heavy metal. So and also that was kind of a time when Nirvana and Pearl Jam were around as well. So I kind of liked all of that kind of music, you know, really big into Nirvana. And then that kind of progressed into heavy metal. So Metallica, Megadeth, you know, stuff like that. And then I learned the guitar, although I wasn't very good at it. And I sang as the front man of the band. And I was telling the wife earlier that I went to a boys' school, a Catholic boys' school, and then there was a Catholic girls' school across the road. And my friend who was in the band with me, he lived next to the girls' school. So he had like this window that you could go out, and we set like the amps and the sound up and the guitars on the roof, so that when all the girls come out of the school, we were like playing our guitars and singing. Like we were doing impromptu concerts, like when the girls went to school, just to like, hey, look at me. So yeah, so I was into live music for a bit. And then all of a sudden one day I heard like jungle. So jungle music, like the origins of drum and bass. And yeah, that took me on a whole different journey. And that kind of then transcended into UK Garage, which is basically US house in the late 90s that was sped up, that kind of the people in the UK really embraced. So people like Matt Jam Lamont, Carl Toughenough Brown, they were true innovators of it, alongside DJ Spoonie, you know, lots of Ramsey and Fenn, you know, and lots of these guys now. That I listened to in my late teens, you are now good friends of mine. You know, I play golf with them. I make music with them. I've made music with two of those legends that inspired me to get into music. And so, yeah, I was just heavy into that back in the days where we used to buy vinyls. And because the whole music scene's totally changed now. As I say, you know, you can, if you want to listen to some music back in the day, you had to go and find and hunt for it and beg and really ask nicely if we could have them really cool records under the counter. You know, now if I want to listen to a song, I could probably find a song in 5 seconds on my phone and play it. You know, so it's kind of the way that music's innovated technologically wise is a very, very good in many ways, but it does feel sometimes that kind of magic and that mystery of having something that was very desirable, that was hard to get, you know, is not as prevalent as it was 30 years ago.
Okay, so then how did that thing, you now become professional in the world?
Yeah, so I bought a set of decks, and yeah, I just kept practicing and practicing. And then when I was about 18, 19, I left London, which is where I grew up, and I moved to a place called Stoke-on-Trent. So Stoke-on-Trent is actually, if you don't know, the birthplace of Robbie Williams. Slash from Guns N' Roses is also from Stoke.
Yeah.
And Lemmy from Motorhead. So actually the guy that I run the record label with, the guy that manages all the and services all the records, his uncle is actually Lemmy from Motorhead. So there's some really famous people from Stoke. Yeah, so I ended up moving there, and because I had some links to some of the music scene that wasn't as strong in the Midlands in Stoke, so that was very hard house trance kind of driven. My stuff was a little bit more kind of diverse, you know, maybe R&B influence kind of UK garage type stuff. We started to put on a few parties, and we started to do all right. And I got recognized by someone that later on became my business partner, who owned a couple of clubs in the city. And over a couple of years, I think my work ethic shone through, and I was programming all of the venues for all their local DJs. I was putting on events with some of the biggest names on kind of the R&B, urban and UK garage scene. I was doing Head Candy parties, and Head Candy at the time was the biggest thing in house music, you know, back then in those funky house days. It was amazing. And again, weirdly, a guy that I booked for one of the Head Candy parties, John Jones, who was pretty much their main DJ back in the day, he's now a good friend of mine, weirdly. He DJed with me on at the weekend in down by London in Marlowe's. Yeah, it's really cool how like all these full circle moments keep happening to me, that, you know, people that, you know, I used to look up to and you know, aspire to be, you know, it's great that I can now call them my friends and, you know, just call them up and, hey, how are you doing? Or do you want to go play golf? So I started running all the nights in the Midlands, and then, yeah, that just got really, really busy. And then off the back of that, I had a lot of time on my hands in the day. So I set up some youth projects. So basically, you know, when I was at school, you know, it was, school didn't work for me. I was a bit naughty and, you know, probably didn't have the attention span that kind of people needed back then for mainstream education. And the good thing is nowadays that the government in the UK, they recognise that not everyone learns in the same way. Mainstream school isn't for everyone. So England now, you know, I left school with 4 GCSEs, you know, and I ended up selling a company over 10 years of growing for quite a substantial amount of money. So it didn't matter that school didn't work for me, but one thing I did have was that strong work ethic, you know, was that ability to be motivated and to grasp everything that I do and turn it into something good and positive. So, yeah, so we started to run these youth projects in the day, and they started to go really well. So basically getting the most difficult, hard to reach, disenfranchised children who were in their teens that had all the negative influences around them. I mean, Stoke-on-Trent, the city where I did it, 60 most deprived local authority in the whole of the UK. So a lot of social disadvantage, a lot of discrimination and prejudice as well. At one stage, we had 5 councillors on the local council from the BNP. Now, the BNP in England stands for the British National Party. Okay. So in essence, Nazis in suits. So you're trying to develop and grow a, you know, a town that has had a lot of disadvantage. I mean, at one stage, it was thriving. So Stoke-on-Trent is the heart of the pottery industry. So if you go to a restaurant, where are you now? Where are you in the world?
I'm in South Africa, Johannesburg.
Okay, so I went to Johannesburg recently, 2 years ago. Yeah, so we stayed at the Saxon Hotel, I believe.
Yes.
And then we went to the game reserve, Shambhala.
Yes.
And I was at Shambhala in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And one thing I always do, because, you know, we always like to, you know, I'm sure, you know, when we're somewhere and you see, you know, like the boerewurst, is that how you say it? Or the braai, let's get the braai, yeah? You know, all that kind of, I'm sure when you're in another part of the world,
yes,
and they've got that, you feel like you're at home. So me, because I spent so much of my life in Stoke, I love the city and it was very kind to me and I love it. So when I'm somewhere in it around the world, I get my plate and I turn it over. And 80% of the time, that pottery is from Staffordshire or Stoke-on-Trent.
Oh, so wow.
Churchill, Dudson, Port Merion, Royal Doulton, you know, Wedgwood, all of these, yes, brands, they originated from Stoke. So Stoke-on-Trent, okay, was born in the, you know, when like Britain had this big industrial revolution.
Yeah.
Because Stoke-on-Trent was built over somewhere which had a lot of great clay, which was used for that. So Stoke-on-Trent suffered when a lot of the manufacturing went abroad, etc. Because, you know, ultimately in the UK, a lot of that does. So anyway, the point is Stoke-on-Trent suffered a lot of disadvantage, you know, generations of worklessness, you know, generations of poverty, etc. So we got lots of these kids, we got them off the streets, we got them doing creative arts, we just rounded them up and got some decks on the go, and the boys were MCing, and then all of a sudden all these young girls started turning up. We were like, why have we got girls coming to this? And we realized it was because they wanted to be where the boys were. So we started to do other projects for the girls. So we did things like nail art and just any sort of activity that helped you build relationships with younger people and build their confidence and build trust and relationships. And then the councils started to come to us and say, look, you know, you're engaged with all these kids. Can you help us get them into college? Because they're not doing anything. They're just leaving school, getting kicked out of school. Can you help us? So we had a few contracts where we would get kids back into employment, education and training. That then snowballed into opening an Ofsted registered school. So that was a proper regulated school for children where they could come and do the boring stuff like English, maths and science in the morning. But in the afternoons, we'll teach you how to DJ. We'll teach you how to make music. We'll go and do sport with you. And it was great. And, you know, the schools would just be like, right, you have this child. We can't cope, but you can. We'll pay you to take them. And then, yeah, and then that snowballed into opening children's homes. So we then opened a small group of, well, actually it was the biggest independent provider of social care in the West Midlands. And yeah, we worked with some, again, really, really challenging children who had some terrible things done to them, you know, and, you know, serious cases of neglect. And yeah, we gave them a safe space to live. So we did all of that for 10 years. And then I started that in 2009. And in 2012, just as I was kicking on with the Cash Only project, I had like 100 people working for me. And I was just like, I need to make a decision here, what I'm going to do. So that's why the whole Cash Only thing just got mothballed for 10 years. And then in 2019, I sold that company. Part of it was like charitable, so it was a social enterprise. But some of it was also privately owned by us because we also needed wages. And I kind of just shelved my whole music career for 10 years. So yeah, 2009 sold it. And then kind of 21, 22, got back into music. And here we are in 2025. You know, we've been back in the studio and back DJing for 2 or 3 years now. And yeah, it's a total different animal, total different scene. It's challenging, but it's fun. I mean, at 45, I'm not sure how long I won't be doing this as well. You know, I feel a bit that maybe I'm a bit too old for it nowadays. But look, I've loved music ever since, as I told you, from in my early teens, you know, 13, 14. And everything that I've done, you know, has always been around music. Even the youth projects, they were always driven through creativity, through the arts. You know, anything that we can do to empower children is always a positive thing. And I think that the arts, if I reflect on my journey at school, I basically built a business and a youth project for myself when I was kind of 12 or 13. And if that would have been around when I was there, maybe I would have got to where I would have got to quicker. So yeah, that's where we're at now. And I still do have some business interests in some other social care based businesses, which do great work with children, but I'm not the chief executive anymore. I literally, you know, turn up to a meeting once a month or check in on them from time to time. I'm there if they want advice. But no, I'm throwing my all into doing music because, I actually haven't got a job, but I've never been busier. It's like today, I literally haven't stopped. And, you know, often I'm in the studio now and, you know, I come in here and even turning the equipment on to make music is often a challenge because there's that many emails, that many social content you've got to do.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's really, really tough at times.
Twofold. How has social media, the platforms, do you feel have affected the youth and children over a period of time in the world? Obviously, from your experiences dealing with the kids and what they're going through, has it been a positive? Has it been a negative? Are there obviously pros and cons? How do you feel has it changed or affected the music industry?
Social media for children is a blessing and a curse, you know. There's no better way for a child to feel good about themselves than seeing a post that they've done got hundreds of thousands of likes and, you know, it kind of gone semi-viral. But equally, there is a lot of bullying that happens on social media. I mean, my 15-year-old daughter, she'll never let me take a picture of her with her and post it. You know, I'll say, can I have a picture? And the first thing she'll say is, you can't post it. You know, and that's a bit worrying that children are that self-conscious about how they appear online and stuff. You know, me as a dad, I just want to take nice pictures of my kids and post them on the internet as like a mobile scrapbook, you know, like that will always be there for years to come and even potentially be a legacy for my great-great-grandchildren to say, oh, what did great-granddad do? Just go on his social media, go and check out. This is who he was. But yeah, and when we had the children's homes, when we were looking after some really emotionally damaged children, social media often was an instigator for a lot of problems. You know, it could put them in a really bad mood if something happened on there. Yeah, there's even gangs in the local area that would arrange to meet up on social media and fight, you know. So I do think that social media with children has to be managed. How you do that is sometimes or often difficult. But yeah, but equally, as I say, you know, if my daughter ever posted a picture and it got hundreds of thousands of likes, she'd come in the room, well, Dad, look, you know, it gives them a sense of fame, you know. Which kind of leads into the music industry. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff, as I say, that I think is music is now being digested by the eyes rather than the ears at times. But then there's a lot of DJs now that have been TikTok or Instagram famous that have thought, oh, how can I monetize what I do? Well, I've got the audience. I've got a community. People like me as a person. How can I meet them? I'll learn to DJ and let's DJ. Or I might make some songs. And, you know, so yeah, it's challenging times because some of the most amazing, talented producers ever are struggling because maybe they're not as attractive on the eye as some of these other influencer people that are coming through. You know, and I'm kind of on that side of the fence where I'm one of these creatives, I'm one of these producers, you know. I'm going to be 50 in 5 years. Like, who wants to look at me jumping up and down behind the decks? But I don't know if it's a bad thing. It's just change, you know. Look at the way that we used to consume music, from vinyl to tapes to CDs to mini discs. Then there was a bit of a lull in vinyl, and then there was a bit of a lull between the time when vinyl shifted over to people buying music. It took a bit. If it wasn't for Apple making and Spotify making an affordable platform for people to buy music, I think people would still just be bootlegging and downloading stuff illegally, which wasn't good for anyone. But yeah, I mean, Spotify and Apple Music, you know, have done a lot for the scene, but, you know, equally they have their critics, which, I make music predominantly for clubs and for Spotify. I want people to be able to listen to my music in the car and at home, but equally if they hear it in a club, to be excited by it. Yeah, you know, I think it just times have changed. 50 years ago, my nan used to send me to the greengrocer's to buy 2 kilos of potatoes. Now I just go to the supermarket, you know. Times change, things evolve.
Yeah.
And if you apply yesterday's thinking to today's problems, you'll end up with the dinosaurs.
Exactly. Like that.
Exactly.
Why, when you started Cash Only, did you want to transition a little bit more into house compared to the type of music you were creating previously?
I mean, the kind of market for the music that I was doing previously has kind of died out. It was a massive, massive movement in the UK for maybe 3 to 8 years. And, you know, the DJs that were big on that scene back then, there's maybe one that everyone will know, and he's a guy called EZ, which, you know, he's still very iconic, and people have still heard of him, and he can tour internationally. But most of the other guys, you know, the scene died out.
Okay,
not many people managed to transition. So if you still were passionate about music and you wanted to try and make music for a community, there's no better kind of scene than the house scene, because house is very, very diverse. And, you know, I make a lot of South African, Afro-inspired music. You know, one of my biggest tracks this year was with a guy from South Africa called China Charmeleon, who you may or may not have heard of. But, you know, he's pretty well known out there on the whole Afro house and Amapiano sound scene.
Yep.
So yeah, you know, that's one part of influence you can take. You can make house music influenced by garage and even jungle. You know, Goldie, who you must have heard of, you know, the famous DJ, graffiti artist, actor. He made a house album not so long ago, you know, which was really cool. So house music, in essence, you know, a 4/4 beat at 125 to 130 BPM, you can infuse so many influences into that sound, and that's what kind of gives me the inspiration for all the music that I make.
Now that you've got all these people that you looked up as growing up, as your friends, your go-to on the phone, playing golf with them, are there ever moments where you actually like the imposter syndrome was like, oh, is this, I'm actually playing golf with this person? Or is it just natural now?
Yeah, I mean, it's really natural now, and, you know, like, yeah, it is natural. And it's a blessing and a curse as well, because, you know, I don't like asking them for favors or stuff like, you know, like they're, you know, significantly artists to me. I sometimes feel like I'll send them a track and say, oh, do you think you could, you know, do you like this? Could you play it? If they like my music, they'll play it anyway. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, maybe a while ago that it was like that. But now I feel that I like to think of myself as one of their peers. I might not be as big as them or as influential as them. But look, I'm about, and, you know, again, there was a big full circle moment where I had a track on Radio 1 not so long ago. Oh, no, sorry, it was Radio 2. And one of those artists that was probably my biggest influence as a kid to be a DJ, he made my track of the week. I was listening to his mixes and whatnot on tapes and my Walkman all those years ago. And then 30 years later, he made a track that I made in a track of the week. So yeah, that was a really cool moment. And, you know, I thanked him for it and whatnot. And that was really cool. And it, things like that make it all worth it, because everyone thinks this, you know, being a DJ is all this kind of glamorous, oh yeah, everyone wants to be a DJ now kind of thing. But let me tell you, you know, it's not easy. On this weekend, I'll be on the road from Friday. I'll be on the train straight into London, in the studio all day. I've got a DJ at Ministry of Sound on Friday night. Then I've got to get a train for a couple of hours down to Brighton, which is where there's the Brighton Music Conference. So I've got to play there. And I've got to get a train for 4 hours going all the way to somewhere called Sheffield to play at a festival with quite a few big names. So like, that's going to be a tiring weekend. Don't get me wrong. I'm grateful for it. And I appreciate the fact that people have booked me. But it's not all kind of glamour and, you know, party and, oh, look at me. Look at me. I'm this big famous DJ. You know, I'm very much still an emerging artist and just doing my best out there. And, you know, the times where you can take a rest, you need to, because it can be very tiring on the road.
A lot of people are the observations of the industry who are not in it, to maybe go to a couple of shows, whether events, festivals, concerts. They think the artists have this, as you mentioned, this glamorous, dynamic life, but it's on and off planes, on and off trains, waiting, on to the next thing. They don't realize that it's actually quite difficult and quite tiring. So you've just explained that to the listeners.
Another example, like, so I was in Barbados last week. I flew straight into Heathrow overnight, landed at 5:30 in the morning, and I've been working at a festival for the last 3 days. We programmed all the music. So we do a really cool, actually his family are from South Africa. His name's Jack Blumenthal. So that's a South African name, I believe. Yeah. And his dad's a really, really famous chef, and he's a famous chef as well. So me and him and a rum company, we did a triple collab where it's kind of rum meets fried chicken, meets music. So we just had a party for 3 days, and yeah, programming all the DJs, doing the after parties and just having fun. And so I hadn't been in my own bed for 2 weeks. You know, literally got home last night, you know, literally watched one TV program, fell asleep.
It's challenging and difficult. People don't realize that. So being a DJ, focusing specifically on that, it's very important to understand and read the energy of the room and the audience. Is that something that's come naturally to you, or you've had to develop and work on it over time?
It's something that comes naturally now, but I would say that I didn't understand it properly until maybe since I went back into music like 3 years ago. So my favorite set is the warm up. So when the room is empty,
okay,
taking people on a bit of a journey, paying respect to the DJ that's coming on after me, because a lot of the time when I'm doing a warm up set, it will be a significantly bigger name DJ. It's always respectful to build the room up and play the music that works, that slots him straight in. So him or her straight in, so they can plug in and take it to that next level. So yeah, my favorite part of the night, you know, I get some incense, burn the incense, and just build the energy and the vibes up slowly, you know, build the BPMs up, build the energy up, give them a few moments, take them back down, give them a moment, bring them back down, and just slot it into the right BPM for the next artist.
And how much of your set is remixes or playing of other artists? And your own originals, is it 50-50, 100% your own? What is the balance?
The art of being a DJ is to have the, you know, 50% of the art is mixing, 50% is to have the top selection. But a lot of my music is what they call edits. So there'll be like very famous vocals put over other instrumentals, or there'll be totally new instrumentals that I've made. I'll play some of my own music. I'll play some music from guys that I respect in the industry. I just play music that I like. And, you know, sometimes you have to throw the crowd a bit of a bone. If things aren't going the way that you want them to go or shouldn't be going by a certain time, then you will have to throw like a big one in there that everyone knows. And I've got a couple of them, you know, it's kind of the get out of jail playlist. Right. Yeah. Have that, you know, and then a lot of DJs do something like it's one for me, one for you, one for me, one for you, you know. But yeah, if you're not playing your own music in your sets, then why are you bothering? You know, why are you bothering to make it? But obviously breaking music is often difficult as well. But you always know when the track works because you know how many Shazams it's done. You know, if you just played it to 1,000 people and all of a sudden the Shazam count's gone mad, you know that people are going to their phone and thinking, oh, what's that? I really like that.
Yeah. Do you ever, as an artist, get reports from Shazam on the tracking of your songs?
Yeah, so there's a website called SongStats, and what that does is it pulls in all the data. Not only do I go, oh, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, you know, the news channel. Oh, now I've got another addiction. I need to check how I'm performing. So Spotify artists and SongStats. So I know when it's been played on radio. I know when it's been put into a mix. I know what chart position it's currently charting at, you know, all these kind of things. So yeah, I know all of that stuff. And, you know, me as a businessman, and that's how I approach this, you know, with a business head, is key metrics are important. So you need to track your data. You know, you can't grow a business or grow yourself as an artist if you're not tracking what you're doing. You know, when I ask artists, like, well, what was your last chart position or whatever, if we're looking to sign a record to the record label and they don't know, that worries me a little bit in some respects, because in some ways they're like, well, I don't know. I'm just making music and putting it out there. They like it. They don't. But equally, this is a business and we can't spend all this money on promoting records and whatnot if we're not going to, you know, wash our face financially at the other side. So I treat what I'm doing very businesslike. And you know, with that, I think the amount of growth that I've done in 3 years. I mean, this time last year, I did 10,000 streams on Spotify. This weekend, I celebrated doing 1 million. So if I apply that same multiple to this year to next year, then who knows where we could be?
Hello. Let's put it out there. So while you were doing the student programs, was there ever that desire or longing or feeling of, oh, I'm not doing music? Or were you just so focused and busy with this youth programs that it really didn't cross your mind?
That thought and feeling of DJing and playing and making music never goes away, but it was just too big a responsibility. At the time when we sold the company, we had 180 staff. We looked after 44 of the most disadvantaged, challenging children in the UK. We had a school looking after, I think, 25 children who, again, were lost in the system. And you know, it was just too big a responsibility to not give my all. You know, I'd wake up in the morning, I'd go to work at 5 a.m. and I'd come back at like 6 p.m. You know, I totally just focused on the business, you know, at the detriment of missing most of my children growing up, etc. So I'm grateful for what we did. I'm grateful for the outcomes that we gave the children that we work with. And I'm grateful for it making me, you know, basically comfortable so that no matter what happens, we'll always be all right.
The podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message to the audience, what would you like to say?
Well, I mean, if you're into music and you're an artist and you're trying to break through into this really difficult industry at the moment. I mean, the UK is having nightclub closures almost weekly. Festivals are getting cancelled. You know, times are really tough out there. If you really want to make it as an artist, then do it because you believe in music. Don't do it because you want to be famous, because, you know, you have to do it because you love it, and you have to do it because it's fun. You know, I always say to myself, this is harder than what I thought. And the minute it stops becoming fun, stop doing it, you know. And there's been a few little moments where that might have happened. I mean, I was in Ibiza recently. I flew out there to do a show and I was just like, I've had enough of this. And then I played this set and it was like, yeah, that was all worth it. And yeah, we've got a busy summer coming up and there's lots of amazing shows, you know, Glastonbury, Ministry of Sound, Reading Festival, Parklife Festival. You know, there's going to be so many sick events and I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, it's challenging. So yeah, if you're an artist, and no matter what art form you do, whether it be art, whether it be music, whatever, creative people are often as well, you know, they're not the most confident of people at times. Mm. They're absolutely incredible at producing what art form they produce, but they don't always have that business head on them or that resilience that you need. You know, a graphic designer will be so offended sometimes if you send them, oh, I like the flyer, but can you change it and do this, that and the other? You know, us creatives, we are quite sensitive. So yeah, look, you know, so if you're in the music scene and you want to make it, just have fun, you know, just do your best, do it because you love it. Good things will happen, I'm sure. And be consistent. I think that's a message to everyone out there in anything that they do. Just be consistent. You know, don't worry if your last Instagram post of your dog didn't do crazy numbers. I'm sure people still love your dog and they still love you. But just be consistent with everything that you do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.